So the theme today is the third foundation of mindfulness. And we're really continuing with the explorations of the last 2 weeks. And again, it's been fun to do a very traditional teaching and try to, as best I can, bring it to life for all of us. And so I wanted to do a very brief review of where we've been, which is focusing on the first and second foundation of mindfulness. And again, it's useful to say a little bit about what this capacity is that we call mindfulness. Again, the word is sati, not the best translation, I believe, of mindfulness. It was a word chosen by Victorian scholars, probably, 120 years ago or so. And it can be confusing because we're really talking about being aware of our experience. And some teachers and scholars would prefer the term awareness as opposed to mindfulness. Awareness doesn't, as it were, give a preference to the mind as opposed to the body or the heart, whereas the word mindfulness can convey that, although I think probably the meaning is it means something like being present to. So some I like words like awareness and presence a little bit better. And so mindfulness is talked about in this core text, which you could read further, the foundations of mindfulness, or the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, or sometimes called the discourse on the establishment of mindfulness. And mindfulness is taken to be, sati is taken to be, a capacity which is the primary tool or resource for purification. So it's not some small thing. And we can see, and we'll see very clearly from what we explore today, that some of the more so-called secular appropriations of mindfulness are superficial. Mindfulness can simply mean being present or even having developing capacity to relax and be present. And so the core connotation of mindfulness in the teaching is that it's connected with wisdom and connected with liberation. That dimension's sometimes lost in the contemporary way of interpreting mindfulness in a secular way. Sati, or mindfulness, knows what is present and keeps it before awareness as the capacity of stability. So mindfulness is connected with concentration, with stability of mind. We can, if we look carefully, we can begin to see how mindfulness is related to the other qualities that we develop, as in the traditional teachings through the Noble Eightfold Path. Again, that mindfulness is directly related to concentration, to being skillful, to being ethical even, that all of these different factors are related. And related to the ethical dimension, mindfulness is taken to be a capacity which protects us. It guards us against being caught in reactivity and confusion and delusion. Very closely related to wisdom, to seeing things how they are. The continued development of mindfulness lets us see both individual states, but also start to see patterns of experience. So we know that mindfulness is present-centered. Many contemporary interpreters talk about it as being non-judgmental. That connotation is not there in the original text, but I think it's fair enough. That we have, basically, mindfulness is non-reactive awareness, presence to what's happening. And I often like to distinguish, this is my own interpretation, not the text, that we can experience mindfulness especially in three main forms. The first is simply noting what's present. And that would be the naming. Oh, I have a planning thought again, right? That's the noting. The second dimension, we explored this in the guided meditation, is exploring the nature of experience by being present and mindful. Anger is there. Let me be mindful of the anger. What's it like in the body? When I stay with anger, does it change? Where does it go to? What's it like in terms of the thought or narrative? So there's a whole dimension of mindfulness, which is that of investigation, exploration, looking carefully. And this is especially helpful for our practice because mindfulness, really taken carefully, can give us a lot of interest, curiosity, in the exploration of experience. That's where our practice comes alive, when we get really interested. Oh, gosh, look at that. Anger or happiness. What is this about? Right? So it takes us out of the way that we sometimes have our practice be what one Tibetan teacher called stupid meditation, which is more where we're, it's not entirely negative, but where we're just sort of pleasantly hanging out and relaxing some. But we're not necessarily seeing a lot. And our meditation can very easily turn into that. Oh, just kind of cool out. And so part of my motivation for these sessions is to deepen the quality of investigation, which is very linked to interest, curiosity, and it brings the practice alive when we start to get really interested in the various patterns. And so that investigation, exploring, and that can be related to the ability to see patterns, to see, oh, look at that. Here, this tends to trigger my anger. Okay, and we see, oh, that pattern of triggering. Or when I have that thought, I tend to go there. So I'd like to think of those three main forms of mindfulness. Just knowing what's happening, which is a kind of a naming or noting, and then the investigation or exploration. And then thirdly, really kind of related to the second, is seeing patterns. And so we have to be able to be present in a way in which we're not trying to fix. We're not trying to change things, per se. And in fact, the first three factors of mindfulness, or the first three foundations of mindfulness, I should say, are really about that capacity for being present. The valuable part of our practice is to know how to be skillful, for example, with difficult thoughts and emotions. That doesn't come under the first three foundations, right? The skillful response. How can I be skillful if I'm in a very difficult state? Very crucial for our practice. But here the emphasis is on just being present. I'll come back to that point, because in a way, if the experiences we're having make it hard for us to be mindful, we have to do what's necessary to be able to be mindful. If we're feeling overwhelmed, what helps me move away from overwhelm so I can be more present? It might take a while. It might be not possible in this sitting. The first foundation, which we explored 2 weeks ago, and we have the recordings are on the website. Thank you. The first foundation is mindfulness of the body. And in the text, there are six ways to be mindful of the body. We explored three of them, and those are being mindful of the body in meditation, especially of the breath or of the body, much like the guidance a little while ago. Another way is to be mindful of when we're in different postures, to be aware of the body in different postures. And then the third way, very applicable for our daily lives, is to be mindful during activities. There are three other ones, which are to be mindful of the elements of the body. This is more earth, air, fire, and water, as understood in the body. And a further one is being aware of the different parts of the body, and then also to be aware of decaying bodies in charnel grounds. The last three we don't practice so much in the West, although there's some interest in bringing those back. And so Bob Stahl, who lives in Santa Cruz, once a year takes practitioners to witness an autopsy. It can be quite profound to be with a decaying body, you know, human body, another kind of a body, and just to, you know, to be aware that bodies are impermanent, which we both know and we don't know. The second foundation we explored last time, I made the case that it's right at the heart of all of our practice. Because, and again, on the surface, it wouldn't seem that important or even interesting, being mindful of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Yeah, that's the point, right? But again, if we work with the teachings, we see the way in which the pleasant, when we're not mindful, leads to wanting and grasping, a form of reactivity. The unpleasant, when we're not mindful, leads to not wanting and pushing away. And again, that often happens virtually automatically. Someone says something mean, I react back, which is a form of, this is unpleasant, I'm pushing it away. Being judgmental of self or other is another manifestation of that. And a lot of that, a lot of the way that the pleasant leads to grasping or the unpleasant leads to pushing away is connected with where we most suffer. And so looking at that dynamic and particularly seeing the roots of reactivity and its two forms, grasping and pushing away, in the pleasant or unpleasant, is the heart of our practice. Because I think that, you know, I interpret dukkha, as you know, and the aim of practice is to understand dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. I understand dukkha as reactivity in its most relevant meaning. It has different meanings, but the most relevant one for our practice is reactivity. It's this grasping and pushing away, and each of those occur in 20 different ways in our experience. So with the second foundation, we have different ways of doing it. I gave a handout last time, maybe 10 different ways to practice with feeling tone. One of them was given in the guided practice, and that would be to look out for when the pleasant is strong or the unpleasant is strong, and watch the mind. Powerful practice. Really powerful. It can save a lot of suffering if you work with that a lot. And we have to do that over and over again. How many people have been practicing for more than 5 years? There was a New Yorker cartoon. It was New Yorker, maybe not New Yorker, but New Yorker-like, in which there were two monks talking to each other, and they said, I think this enlightenment business doesn't happen right away. I've brought a sack lunch. You know, so it takes a while, and it's the repetition of noticing the cycles moving from pleasant to reactivity, unpleasant to reactivity, over and over and over again. At a certain point, we get it, and something may fall away, but we need to look at that over and over again. The third foundation is usually taught as mindfulness of thoughts and emotions. And I added in the guidance, we could say thought-emotion complexes, because thoughts and emotions are intimately connected. We have a kind of mythology in the West that thoughts are different than emotions, but they're not. Or I think as is disclosed by cognitive science and, you know, and just looking closely at experience, that emotions are cognitively formed. You know, there's, I don't want to get into this too much, but there's one, I think, widely accepted set of distinctions in psychology, that there's a threefold distinction between affect, feeling, and emotion. Affect is what is more universal and given and grounded in the body. It's what appears, you know, and not necessarily conscious. There's some kind of noticing, and that's some kind of sensation that has an evaluative component that doesn't necessarily register in the mind. People can have some anger as an affect and hardly know it. When it comes to consciousness, it could be called feeling. Physiologically based, and yet not fully coming into consciousness necessarily. A third dimension is called emotion, and this is always socially constructed. In other words, how anger appears in in the United States, it's going to be different from how anger appears in Thailand. That's not widely known by translators, and so when you see translations of the text, the Buddhist text, and they use a word like anger, they're missing the different cultural connotations. And it's a big deal. Maybe I'll give a talk on anger, because I think it's a very major issue, actually. Because in the short version is, what is translated as anger from the Asian languages, the Asian Buddhist languages, is anger is very close to hatred. It's entirely negative in connotations. In the West, that's not the case. Because, guess who gets angry? God. The Jewish prophets. Jesus. Anger is sometimes a good thing in the Western tradition. The word that's translated as anger, dosa, never a good thing. And some of the other words, it's always negative. So that's just an example. It's related to the fact that they're actually in the Asian languages that are connected with the Pali and Sanskrit, the languages of the suttas. There's actually no word for emotion. We have the word citta, and you'll see that the word citta is what we're mindful of for the third foundation. And so that's why for Western teachers generally understand that as thoughts and emotions, but citta is usually translated as mind, but it really covers what we would call thoughts and emotions, but they're all grouped under one heading, citta. And in the Buddhist model, experience is divided up into body and citta, whereas in the West, it's a threefold distinction. So it's interesting. I mean, it's a little bit of a scholarly point, but I think it's necessary for making sense of this text, because citta, I would say in our own experience, it means pay attention to thoughts and emotions, and particularly those involving reactivity and non-reactivity. Okay, so let's read together the first paragraph of the third foundation of mindfulness. It's in the handout. And the word bhikkhu literally means monk, but let's think of that as meaning practitioner, not any gender connotation. Together, And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind as mind? Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and mind affected by lust, or unaffected by lust, as mind unaffected by lust. He understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind, and distracted mind as distracted mind. He understands exalted mind as exalted mind, and unexalted mind and as unexalted mind. He understands surpassed mind as surpassed mind, and unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed mind. He understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind, and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. He understands liberated mind as liberated mind, and unliberated mind as unliberated mind. So, for our purposes, I think the first set of instructions about greed and hatred and delusion are probably the most important. So what this is inviting us to look at, I think, like I say, most Western teachers interpret this as being notice your thoughts and emotions. Notice when there's planning. Notice when there's anger. Notice when there's joy. Notice when there's this repetitive thought. And that's really crucial. You'll see that it doesn't come in that exact way in the text. But rather in the text, there's particularly looking out for certain kinds of patterns of mind, certain kinds of qualities of mind. The first three are especially about looking for reactivity. Say, like, really, it's basically saying, really look out for greed, which is the grasping that we just talked about, hatred, which is the pushing away, or sort of shorthand for that, and then the delusion is when we're just not aware. That's harder. It's harder to be aware when we're not aware. But what this is basically doing is saying, pay special attention to the grasping and the pushing away, and particularly the form of hatred. Study them. See what they're like. Right? Really, we could say that the word that's used for, that's translated as hatred, is dosa, which again is more of a range of anger, ill will, and the various forms that that could take. Could take a form of being judgmental. So, and again, the grasping could take all sorts of forms. It could be take form in thoughts and emotional complexes and so forth. So, what this is also saying is be aware of when there's non-reactivity. And these are not commonly given instructions, right? But I think important, be aware of when you're non-reactive. That's interesting, right? Be aware of when you're balanced or calm or seeing clearly. That's what this text is saying. That's just, in other words, don't just look for the negative with our negativity bias, but look for states of mind when you're clear, and know that you're clear. Give yourself a brownie point. I think that's the message. Yeah. But especially for our conditioning, where we're used to just focusing on the negative, we want to look for reactivity, but we also want to look for when things are really clear and notice that. And again, I think that's an underdeveloped part of our practice, I would say, to really pay attention to when we're clear, we're non-reactive, we're noticing. That's what this text is asking us to do in the first set of instructions. And so it's implicitly also giving us some kind of guidance and saying, know how to distinguish between skillful states and unskillful states, and develop the skillful and try to work through the unskillful. The unskillful are greed, hatred, and delusion. The skillful are forms of non-reactivity. So there's an implicit message here that mindfulness is about developing the skillful states and not being caught by the unskillful states. That's why this can be purifying. And again, so when I study this text closely, I get certain messages that are both not commonly given in core instructions, nor are they typically followed very much, this instruction to both really look out for the unskillful states, but then look for when the skillful states are there and know that. Right? So that can be very important. So we can study the wanting and the greed. Notice all the ways it appears. You know, I've mentioned at times when Diana Winston and I led this class on which we called greed management. Remember that? I've talked about that sometimes, right? Where we had this well-publicized class on greed management, and almost no one signed up. Maybe if we had said anger management, it would have been different. But greed management, we had five people, and we were all interested. But the important thing is that we really got to look at the nature of that greed or wanting, you know, and we found it, we studied it. And this is what we do in our mindfulness practice, study the nature of the greedy mind. We found it was always self-centered. It had no sense of consequences. Other people's interests didn't matter, and so forth, right? It's really good to know that. If you know that clearly, are you going to follow greed in your own mind? So you see how the mindfulness leads to wisdom. That's a certain amount of wisdom. Oh, this is what greed is like. Or Achan Sumedho, you know, his instructions for mindfulness are, this state is like this, right? Greed is like this. He makes a hand gesture. Greed is like this. Study it. See what it's like. You know, and similarly, we can really study the complex around the pushing away or the ill will, the anger, the irritation, being judgmental. Study these carefully. See what they're like. And again, I've sometimes talked about one retreat where I got to study anger for 10 days in a row, about 16 hours a day. You know? And was an amazing experience. Luckily, it was in the workable range, but it was amazing. I had never looked at anger closely. And after that, it was totally different, right? And I could see that one of the things that I found that was really interesting was that there were many, many forms of anger. We use anger as one word, but I found petty irritation, very self-centered, sometimes wanting to hurt someone, you know, one kind of anger. I also found anger that was more connected with care and even with love, where it was coming out of a sense of really care about something or someone. And when I stayed with the anger, I went typically to sadness and then to love. Well, that was interesting, right? And again, it's some forms of anger. This is why in the Western traditions, you can have God, Jesus, and the Jewish prophets get angry, because it's coming out of care. It's not coming out of pettiness, right? It's not coming out of necessarily polarization. And so we can study these, or we can. The hardest, of course, is to study delusion. That's an interesting one. When you feel confused, explore it. What's that like? Maybe you have confused thoughts. Let me just be with this and see what it's like. What's it like in the body? What are the emotions? What are the patterns of thinking? You know, and we can, again, we can especially look for when we're non-reactive. And the core teaching, of course, is that our basic nature is luminous and non-reactive. That's why it's very helpful to get familiar with that, to really know, this is a core part of who I am, my non-reactivity. I think that's implicit in the instructions. Again, why it's valuable to look for the positive states, not just for the negative ones. Notice when non-reactivity is there. Tune into your clarity, your equanimity, your balance, our balance, and so forth. And then some of the other instructions go into more detail on other states of mind, to know when the mind is contracted, you know, to know when it's distracted. And contracted here is code for what's usually called sloth and torpor. And distract, it's kind of like when the mind, the contracted mind, is when the mind goes inward in kind of confusion and lethargy. And the distracted mind is when it's more outwardly going all over the place. Right? And so this is basically saying, know those states as well. So all of these further instructions are giving some specificity. Know when the mind is distracted. Know when the mind has sleepiness or lack of energy. And know when it doesn't. Right? Know when you have good energy. Know when you're concentrated, like it goes on a moment later. You know, to know when one has gray or narrow mind, you know, that or surpassable or unsurpassable mind. These are relating to different levels of concentration. Right? I won't go so much into them. Or concentrated and unconcentrated, or liberated and unliberated mind. Know when I'm actually in this moment, I'm free, and notice when I'm not free. And again, I think the instruction is helping in that way. So maybe just a few other things to say. But I think one of the glories of the practice is particularly being able to apply this third foundation to difficult patterns of thoughts and emotions, right, when they occur. I was talking about anger or greed, or can I be with distress related to interpersonal relationships? Can I really bring my mindfulness and hang out with them and see what they're like? And one of the key tools in that is being able to switch, and this isn't so much in the instructions, but maybe something that maybe we bring in as Westerners, is when you're with a challenging state, switch the channels. Be with it at the level of the body. Be with it at the level of the emotions. Be with it at the level of the narratives or thoughts. One of the most helpful ways that that practice can occur is when you take something difficult or painful and you're caught in the storyline, see if you can go into the body and actually notice what's there for you. Sometimes emotion will come up. This is going back to the teaching related to the second foundation, that our reactivity that is developing more negative thoughts is related to the feeling tone that's unpleasant. We could say it's related to pain. And sometimes if we can, with a judgmental thought, anger and so forth, we can go into the body and feel the painful emotion sometimes, or feel the sometimes a physical pain. Sometimes it's a contraction in the chest. So with the judgmental mind, if we can go into the body and we touch the pain, something can get released. This is almost like one of the ways that we can practice with the third foundation is sort of reverse engineering, so to speak, the second foundation. We're caught in reactivity. Can we go back and actually touch the pain? Because if we do that, the reactivity will tend to dry up. It's interesting. Can we do that? So maybe one last thing. The shorthand that is very popular in the insight meditation world for the third foundation is using the acronym RAIN. Many of you know this, probably most of us know this. Recognize what's happening, which is mindfully giving a label. The second is accept or acknowledge, Don't try to fight it. Be with it if it's in the workable range. Be with what's happening. Acknowledge, accept, be present with it. The third is to investigate or inquire. This is, again, what I'm suggesting is the core of the third foundation. And the fourth is non-identification, telling us how to do that really in a way where we're just mindful in a non-reactive way. We just stay with something. So that formula would be a good substitute if you need a short summary of the talk. If everything I said was a little, sometimes too much detail or a lot of detail, and you just want something simple for everyday life, R-A-I-N. So let me finish with one quotation, and we can open things up. This is from the great teacher in the Thai forest tradition, Achan Mun. Of all the many things that people value and care for in the world, a person's mind and heart is the most precious. In fact, the mind and heart is the foremost treasure in the world. So be sure to look after it well. To realize our true nature, the true nature of the mind and heart, is to realize Dhamma. Understanding the mind and heart is the same as understanding Dhamma. Once this is known, then Dhamma in its entirety is known. Arriving at the truth about one's mind and heart is the attainment of Nibbana. So, mindfulness of the third foundation is at the heart of things and related to the first two. So I hope this can motivate us further to practice. Again, a lot of my motivation is to spark that quality of inquiry, spark the quality of interest, because that just makes everything really different. We have more energy for practice. We can bring the practice more to the whole day. Oh, look, I'm getting reactive. Oh, let me look at this. Oh, driving home, I got reactive towards this driver. Oh, let me look at it. So, thank you for your kind attention. And we can open things up if there are any reflections or questions, observations. Peter and Patty in the back. Patty had her hand up first.
Thank you, Don. In practicing with the second foundation only, I noticed that a lot of my reactivity comes from, I traced it to grief.
Grief.
I looked at the grief, and I realized that that was clinging. I wanted somebody who's dying. I wanted somebody who's not going to be here anymore. It was almost like pre-grief, like people who are still here are clinging to knowing they're leaving. And I realized inherent in impermanence, for me, there's grief. I looked at our planet and how it's not thriving. Mm-hmm. And there was grief behind it. And a lot of my suffering, when I looked at the unpleasant, when I looked at it deeply, I realized on a very deep level, I was grieving loss. Mm-hmm. And I saw that as craving, but it also felt natural. I didn't want to necessarily abandon the craving because I felt like that's abandoning an honoring in a way. Mm-hmm. So I really, it's not a dead end, so to speak, but I everything led to grief. And grief looked like clinging, and I couldn't, I didn't want to abandon the clinging, and that in itself was clinging, so I was in a little loop.
Yeah. Well, I would suggest looking carefully at what you're calling the grief. Because I think grief in itself does not involve clinging. And if there's clinging, there's an add-on, I believe. Something is being added to it. So just the deep sadness, I mean, you're talking about kind of preparatory grief, so it may be a little more complex, right? That so my sense is that what you're calling grief is mixed up with a few other things. Maybe some clinging, maybe some judgment, hard to know. Because I think grief by itself, I think is more of a pure energy. And so the and it will tend to just move through. Of course, at our time, for certain of us, if we tune in certain ways, the grief is immense, right? So it can feel like a lot. But I think even so, I would look to see if there's some ways that it's more than just grief. Maybe some commentary, some reactivity. Because the basic instructions that have been useful for me and that I work with grief are just let the grief come through, and then see where you get stuck. See where there's something else. And it may be a sense of overwhelm, or a sense of it's too much, or the sense of loss is connected with some clinging. I think I would look at that. And it's not easy territory.
Thank you.
Does that make some sense?
It does. It's also frightening, but it's worth exploring.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then I would also probably complement that maybe with joy practice. So it doesn't get to be too one-sided, as it were. That's hard, and I think it's an important practice for thinking of Joanna Macy's work. This is very relevant for our times. I was actually just working on, she's having, there's a commemorative volume coming out around her 90th birthday. And I was working today on an essay which I have, which is in the book that's coming out. So I was thinking exactly about some of these things. And in her work, one doesn't actually, in the more structured work that she does, one doesn't actually go into the pain and the grief until you've hung out for a certain amount of time with gratitude and appreciation and more uplifting, gladdening type states of mind. So,
thanks.
Things. One, I'm always still thrown by the fact that these are not binary, wholesome, unwholesome, or unwholesome, and wholesome, and that sometimes you have two unwholesome states in here. But how do you work with, or how do you understand exalted and unexalted, and then surpassed and unsurpassed? Because those are words that are...
Yeah, let me see. Unsurpassed and surpassed is referring to states of concentration, to levels of jhana. And I think, I think exalted is something fairly similar. I had it in my notes. I don't use it a lot. The exalted and sometimes that's translated as great or narrow, and so that is sometimes related to whether the kind of state of concentration is really, really focused or whether it's very broad. I think that's what I have in my notes. So these are kind of technical distinctions within concentration practice, so not so relevant for broadly for our practice. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. And the other thing is, might it be possible at some point when you're here again that we could go into the fourth foundation in the same? I know how complex and diverse it is.
We could. I I was aware that there were four foundations. I'm doing three in a row, three meetings in a row. So I actually, Oren's teaching next week. I asked him, could you handle the fourth foundation? He said, sorry, got a book out. So, I think that would make sense to come back. And the fourth foundation is, I like to think of the first three foundations as learning how to be with the constituents of experience, the various constituents, mind, heart, body, feeling tone. The fourth foundation is about looking through certain lenses at the broader patterns of experience. So first three, get good with being aware of the constituents, and then look at more complex patterns of experience. That's how I understand the fourth. That's not in the text per se, but that's one way of understanding it. Yeah.
I'll see if I can state this. I was working on Vedana during the week, and I came up with a very common pattern line, which is recruiting negative emotions when I have them. And sometimes this takes the form of catastrophizing.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to comment on that particular form of reactivity, because it seems to be connected with some need for control, but at the same time, really ditch my consciousness.
Yeah, catastrophizing. I think it's a learned habit. We may have got that from our parents or from the culture. Sylvia Boorstein talks about having that tendency, and a certain percentage of Jewish people have that. And that's related to history. So it comes with causes and conditions, oh my gosh, things are going to get awful really quickly. Right? Because historically, that's happened. Right? And so some of it could be habit, what one's learned through the family, through the culture. It's finding coherence and meaning where there might not otherwise be meaning.
That's true.
We often prefer a deeply negative meaning to not knowing what's happening. Right? Which is, and so it might be, that this is one of the standard patterns of what one does when one's confused or doesn't know. And so the invitation would be, can you stay more with the unknowing and watch the tendencies to go to a negative scenario? And it typically will be prompted by something unpleasant. So again, if you can stay with the unpleasant and as bring kind of a slow motion attention to what's happening, and that'll be easier in some situations than others, and just start to watch the tendencies to catastrophize. If you can do that, then you can you have enough mindfulness so you can say, I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, it's very difficult, unfortunately, because the unpleasant usually isn't as unpleasant as the fear that follows and then the catastrophizing.
Yeah. So maybe you can, I think it's helpful to sort of bring a magnifying glass, in a way, to the experience. And you just mentioned fear. When that happens again, this is a little bit what I was calling reverse engineering. Maybe the catastrophizing is already happening. Can you just ask yourself, is there fear in my system?
I've already gotten there.
But see, if you can attend to the fear as an energy in the body, and then notice the tendencies to create the stories, that's helpful. Because again, if we think of the sequence in this, that we look at in the second foundation, from feeling tone to not wanting to reactivity. The fear partly is a kind of energy that is partly non-reactive. It's just an energy. and it gets connected with a storyline. And you can sometimes see also, you can ask, what's the story here? Again, so looking at fear carefully can be of incredible value. Again, I am blessed or cursed to have had retreats many retreats where I was focused on one negative quality for days on end. And I had one with fear. And it was really striking to keep studying fear, hour after hour for days on end. And again, it was in the workable range. I was fortunate. But what I found was that virtually all the storylines were pure delusion. It was interesting. It was interesting to see. I was just summoning one story after another, right? And I could see how it was like the fear of the unknown. But if you can, so the fear is, the fear, there's something about it being hard to be with the unknown and the not fully clear.
Yeah, it's hard because sometimes it's like this particular thing was a physical symptom that was very scary.
Oh, yeah.
It is very scary.
Yeah.
And then the catastrophe can develop.
Oh, I see. So something like a medical situation?
Yeah.
Anyone relate to that? Okay. Yeah. So that's something we could talk about together. Like, you have an unknown, difficult medical situation, and the mind starts catastrophizing. How to practice with that? Anyone want to share what you find skillful? Or it doesn't have to be medical. It could be something in some other context. Maybe relational.
So when I go into catastrophizing, my first question always is, what do you really know?
What do you really know? That's great. That's related to where I was going with that, that there's some way that the mind would rather have bad meaning than no meaning at all.
I find that I have a habitual pattern. If I sit in a room where it's relatively a pleasant room, and I don't have any particular thing that I need to do at the moment, and just sit there, and I find myself in a pattern of being discontented for no known reason to just be there quietly.
Yeah.
It's there's a need to do something or have food or go buy something. I mean, but none of these things are really necessary. It's just really the discontent with what's there. It repeats and repeats. And I don't know if there's a practice that can help with that.
Yes. For a reduced price, a special bargain for the next week. It's actually what you're getting at is deep. And it's something I think everyone can relate to, that there, I think a lot of it's cultural. It's like an internal pressure to fill up the space, to do, to get on to the next thing, to get new information, right? It's, this is, of course, what cell phone manufacturers know very well, right? Or people who design websites, they want to get you. But even, and it's something really important to look at. Like, in the middle of nowhere, you're very content, and the urge comes, I need to do something. Let's fill in. Anyone relate to that? It's very fundamental. There's the sense, it's a deep structure of our sense of self as a doer. And what, you know, and I've been amazed sometimes, you know, being on retreat, just sitting on a bench, nothing to do, and noticing some internal pressure to do something, or related to this, is to rush so I can get more done. And I notice this even in the middle of retreat. I mean, and the like you're saying, there's a certain perception of the absurdity of this, right? Right, which is a good starting point, right? And so how to practice with it? When, first of all, note that it's an unconscious conditioning around identifying as a doer, okay? Which again, deep, deep, deep in the culture. Virtually all of us have this in some form or another. And it's something to look at. And so I would say, when you notice something like that, say, let me be mindful and study this. Be aware that it could feel uncomfortable. Sit with the discomfort and just explore it. Keep on exploring it. So that can take us very deeply. But we, again, this is something we've been caught in that conditioning for decades and decades, millions of times, right? So working with it, it's going to take at least a weekend. Right, and you know, I think we're gonna do the meta cards. I'll just one short thing. I'll just say that I once was given instructions for a 10-day retreat. Be aware, but don't do anything, including meditation. Don't do anything, and I found myself really enjoying not doing anything. But I found myself also, after a while, taking credit for doing nothing really well. That's how deep the conditioning is. So please, sorry to delay a little bit. Okay.
Thank you, Donald.